May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm attorney with the Federal Defender's Office, Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Shabaka Boyd. We raise two issues in this appeal. They're both legal issues, purely legal issues, although the government's kind of turned the second issue into a factual one. The first issue, I'm not going to spend any time on it unless this court wants to discuss it. Our position, it's the 924C issue that the Supreme Court ran cert on, so whatever they say goes.
Yeah, so would you recommend that we hold our decision until we hear from the Supreme Court on this?
I think, you know, that might depend on the second issue. Mr. Boyd wants a remand to correct the judgment on that issue, so if you agree with us and you want to affirm based on Easter, I guess we would file a cert petition.
So you contemplate that this remand would simply be for the district court to get rid of the word shall and
yes,
or get rid of the references to the IFRP program?
Yeah, I think that's right. I know this different panel heard oral argument, I think, on February 9th, mm-hmm. Labs, and I think Judge Posner seemed to be concerned that you couldn't do that, but I don't really know why. This court orders limited remands all the time. So to tell a district court to fix a plain error like that, I don't understand why he needs to be resentenced. I just don't understand that. So I think this court can order a limited remand, and that's what we've asked for.
Well, it seems to me one might, if you're conceding that there are no other errors in the sentence, then it's essentially an affirm with a limited with one minor exception, which is to fix this part of it. But that would, as opposed to a Palladino kind of limited remand where we expect somebody to come back
right.
to us, I don't think that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Mr. Hansmeyer, why does this IFRP problem amount to plain error with a serious effect on the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings? Well, what's the big deal?
Well, I think here I'll contrast it with Sawyer, which is the payment schedule case. That case, this court held that it wasn't plain error for a court. Essentially, the statute in that case, I think it's 3664F2, essentially says a court has to set a payment schedule for post-incarceration. Court didn't do that in the case. This court said that wasn't plain error. The difference is, you know, that case, a district court doesn't do something it's required to do. Now, you can rationalize that can be plain error because there can be a situation where, you know, the district court, even if it doesn't act, there's no different outcome. But here you have a situation where a district court mandates something that it has no power to do, but it does it anyway. Here the district court can't order Mr. Boyd to participate in this program, and it did that.
If it's unenforceable, what's the harm?
It's unenforceable?
Yeah, if the Bureau of Prisons is not going to make him do it, make him participate, what's the harm?
I would disagree with that premise. I think the BOP, I don't know that you can say that the BOP isn't going to require him to do it. It's a district court order. To me that's kind of scary.
Well, if a district court orders him to be assigned to, let's say, the Terre Haute Penitentiary,
right.
The BOP won't care about that. They'll treat it as a recommendation that's not binding. Why won't they treat this the same way? If Mr. Boyd goes into prison and says, I don't want to do it.
Well, I think you're right that that's a recommendation, but that's a recommendation by statute. The statute says that's a recommendation. I think the government... So if a district court says he shall serve his term of imprisonment at USP Terre Haute, you know, I think the government has an appealable issue. I don't know if the BOP can ignore that. Can they? I don't know.
Let me come at this a different way. In this particular case, if I recall correctly, the judge did not waive interest requirements. We're talking about a relatively modest amount of money in this particular case, but we can imagine cases where it would be very different.
Right.
But I can also imagine cases in which a judge would say, Well, if this fellow is not going to be participating in the inmate financial responsibility program, then I want to make sure that there's an interest, that the interest is accruing, at least because I want to give him an extra financial incentive. What I'm getting at here is that this is a provision that is not necessarily in isolation in the sentence, and that it may be part of a balanced package of terms of the sentence that, although not in this particular case, but in other cases, a district judge might want to reconsider if he's not going to be able to order the IFRP participation.
You know, I think Judge Posner kind of made that point in the earlier argument, earlier about 3 weeks ago, and I think I disagree with that because it turns a voluntary decision. You know, if I have the choice, if Mr. Boyd has the choice whether to participate, and the judge is going to say, well, if you're not going to participate, I'm going to fine you more, or I'm going to, you know, do something that I normally wouldn't. I mean, is that really a voluntary decision? What's wrong with that?
We do that with sentencing all the time, where voluntary, rehabilitative, compensatory behavior to make up for the consequences of the crime winds up getting somebody a break in the sentence. Why is that troubling?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot wrong with it because a defendant has the choice to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if a district court's saying you're going to be punished more harshly if you don't do it, that's different than, like, say, acceptance of responsibility.
How?
You know, well, because if I plead guilty, you know, that I'm making a conscious choice that I committed a crime and I want to plead guilty.
And if you don't plead guilty, you don't get the acceptance of responsibility. And if the judge follows the guidelines, punishes you more severely. Is that still an involuntary decision to plead guilty for that reason?
No, I made my choice. My choice has nothing to do with the fact. I mean, I know when I don't plead guilty that the judge is going to hit me harder. I know that. And that's something that the guidelines provide for. Here, the statute provides for a voluntary decision. I mean, it's a different situation. You know, I have the choice by statute whether I want to participate or not. The judge says, I'm going to fine you $20,000 unless you participate. How is that a choice? It's not a choice. At least in my mind, it's not a choice.
Well, suppose we're talking about restitution. We don't have that in this crime, but that's often at issue. And you want restitution paid. The judge may want restitution paid from earnings during prison to make a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, is it mandatory? Are we talking about discretionary restitution? I mean, if
it's almost always mandatory.
Right, mm-hmm. So I mean, that's...
But there's a choice about interest and choice about when it has to be paid.
I mean, but there's no statute that gives a defendant the decision on that. I mean, there's no statute that says a defendant decides whether he pays interest. I mean, it's
up to the judge.
Exactly, and this isn't up to the judge. I mean, that situation, the judge decides here... Mr. Boyd decides by statute.
So if Boyd refuses to sign off on the IFRP payment plan that the Bureau presents him with, he could lose privileges.
Yeah, I think there's like 9 things that they can do to him. You know, I told him, you know, I had a conversation with him and told him, you know, I asked him if he wanted to raise the issue. You know, I told him it didn't really, I don't know what it was going to do for him and that he's probably going to want to participate anyway. But he said raise it, so I did.
So and then the Bureau could, if he refused to sign off on it, they could take it from his account based on the order that's in effect now. I mean, even though you're arguing that really it should be voluntary and not mandatory, but they could do that. They could actually take it. And then what would his remedy be at that point if the Bureau of Prisons then took the money out of the account without him signing the form?
Right. Well, are we talking outside of the context of this appeal?
Let's assume this order stands.
Okay.
Okay. Well, then he doesn't sign off on the form. Doesn't he have to still sign off on the form if this order stands, or can the Bureau of Prisons just based on this order take the money out of his account?
I mean, that would be my position, mm-hmm. that based on the district court's order, he doesn't have a choice. I don't see how you can make the contrary argument. It's, I don't know. That's, yeah, I think it's not a choice. My time is up. We just ask for a remand to correct the judgment. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Mr. Mayo.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Brendan Marr, and I represent the United States in this matter.
So, Mr. Marr, listening to your exchange with, or listening to Mr. Hansmeier's exchange with Judge Hamilton makes me think that a remand really is necessary here, because if the district court structured its sentence one way, thinking that these payments were going to be made, and now the district court understands that it's really optional, the district court might want to rethink the sentence, for all I know, in a direction unfavorable to Mr. Boyd, but to rethink it.
Your Honor, I think to get there, you have to get past one of the threshold arguments or one of the threshold issues that is in dispute between the parties here, and that is whether the district court's order is, in fact, a mandatory order at all. And it's our position, you know, as our brief reflects, we have a three-step position that the facts are not developed enough to determine whether or not, with due respect to counsel's conversation with Mr. Boyd, that's not in the record.
But, you know, we have a lot of cases that say the orally pronounced sentence is the one that takes precedence. And looking at the excerpt of the sentencing proceeding that we have, the court does use this word, shall be paid in accordance with. And so I'm not confident that the district court didn't mean that. I mean, why should I assume that? Seems like that's a very dangerous path to go down. The district courts don't mean what they said.
Well, I guess there's two. Our position is there's a different way of looking at that sentence. And the sentence reads, shall be paid in accordance with the Bureau of Prisons Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. If the district court understood that program to be the voluntary program that the Code of Federal Regulations established that it is, and to be clear, the United States is not taking the position that it's not a voluntary program. We agree.
I understand your reading of that, but it seems strained to me. It seems, by the time he says, shall be paid in accordance with this program, the natural reading of that is, you know, whatever periodic payments they make and whatever their arrangements are for withdrawing money from the inmate's account and all the rest of these things. It's just tough to get to where you're suggesting we should go.
But on the front, I guess another way of reading that, again, and we're assuming that the district court judge in this case understands what the program is and is not, but a way of reading that is that the prisoner, the defendant, the fine, I'm sorry, shall be paid in accordance with, and as we do in writing all the time, open brackets, the voluntary, close brackets, Bureau of Prisons. It's a program that by its nature, everyone in this appeal agrees is a voluntary program.
And the only problem is that it's not clear that the district court was focusing on that at that moment. District judges are very busy. They have lots of things to do. I'm sure if you ask Judge Capalla out in the middle of the field, you know, he would know. But it doesn't come through very well on this. And so I'm a little concerned that, you know, if we got down the path that Judge Williams was outlining, where without his permission they started withdrawing money from his account, well, what does he do? Does he file a 2241? Does he file an administrative complaint with the BOP that they're unauthorized withdrawals from his account? I mean, lots of future expensive and needless proceedings could go on for something that everybody agrees how it ought to be structured. So why can't we just either tell the district court, focus on the fact that this is voluntary, and if you want to just reinstate the sentence without the word shall, then do so, or if you want to rethink interest or whatever you want to rethink. So that's one option. Another option is just to say this was a ministerial deviation between the orally pronounced sentence and the written sentence, fix it so that it complies with BOP rules. I mean, there are a couple of things we could do that would maybe save a lot of time at the back end.
Well, I guess the response to that, Your Honor, would be this is case that, again, I think everybody agrees is here, if at all, on plain error review. And getting to Judge Hamilton's question there, we are, in fact, talking about, on the record before this court, what this court has called in another context in Tejeda kind of a meaningless do-over. What he's asking for is to go back so that we can strike one word from a sentence.
It's not meaningless if, for some reason, I don't know why Mr. Boyd would want not to cooperate, but if he really wanted to accumulate his own money in his prison account, accept whatever negative consequences BOP puts on him for that, and then pay when he leaves, unlike the forfeiture situations in Tejada, this could make a difference to him.
But that brings us back to the problem with the record that's presented to the court here. We don't know what Mr. Boyd does and does not want to do. We do not know.
Counsel has represented that he wants to raise this claim. That's his counsel speaks for him.
But, for example, we don't know if he rose his hand in prison and said, or as Judge Williams indicated, said, I'm not signing that. Whether the court, whether the Bureau of Prisons, A, would treat the district court's order as a mandate that despite his refusal to sign on to that order, they're going to do it anyway. We don't know that that's the case. That's not presented by the record before the court.
So you think that the Bureau of Prisons would then try to divine what the district court meant? I mean, if you look at what, I mean, a reasonable reading of it, shall participate, seems pretty explicit to the Bureau of Prisons. Because the problem I have is you're asking us to make this assumption about what Judge Kapala thought this meant.
Well, I guess my argument, or our argument, is a semantic argument, certainly. I'm not necessarily asking the court to divine Judge Kapala's intent. I'm simply saying that the language shall be paid in accordance with the Bureau of Prisons Inmate Financial Responsibility Program, that exact language, shall be paid in accordance with, can be read as saying shall be paid in accordance with what everyone understands to be a voluntary program. And therefore,
so
if he elects
a limited remand, then, I mean, you don't seem to have any substantive quarrel with where things ought to come out.
I don't have any.
Understand why you're fighting it this hard.
We don't have any quarrel with the fact that the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program is a voluntary program. It's our position that in this case, this does not meet plain error review. There is no manifest injustice in leaving this order stand the way it is on the record.
What do you mean by that? You might mean, A, that there's no injustice in requiring Mr. Boyd and Mr. Boyd alone to have a mandatory inmate financial responsibility program, or you might mean, B, there's no manifest injustice because when you read all of this as a whole, it's clear, you might say, that Judge Kapala meant for it to be voluntary. Which are you arguing, A or B?
B, Your Honor.
All right. So you are not arguing that there would be, unlike in the Tejada situation, for example, you're not arguing that it wouldn't be unjust to him to require him to participate.
If, in fact, that were the case, I agree with Your Honor. And, again, the record does not reflect that.
Let me throw one more curveball here that has less to do with this case, but let's suppose we're dealing with a financial crime, and a defendant who pleads guilty seems to be making efforts to prior to sentencing towards restitution, and the judge is persuaded, it looks like he's making an effort and provides a lighter sentence in terms of custody. The judge then discovers with a limited remand here that the inmate is actually resisting efforts to pay back his victims during his incarceration. Would the judge be justified in enhancing the custody part of the sentence as a remand, on remand?
I see my time is up. Would you like me to respond to the question, Your Honor?
If it's all right with her, yes.
Of course, yes.
I think that would fall under the district court's discretion, and that would be something that would be the judge would be entitled to consider, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Your time ran out, but if you'd like another minute, Mr. Hansmeier, you may have it.
I just address Judge Hamilton's point there. I think the problem with this whole idea of, I think what we're missing is at sentencing, you know, Mr. Boyd doesn't stand up and say, I'm going to participate in this program. I mean, he probably doesn't even know about this program. So I think that, you know,
Some inmates do.
I don't know, maybe. I know Mr. Boyd didn't until I mentioned it to him. So I think if there was the procedure at sentencing was, you know, step one, sentence, step two, supervised release, step three, fine, restitution. You know, if there was some sort of trifurcated system, you know, maybe that logic starts to make sense. But, I mean, this stuff comes at the end of a sentence. You know, you worry about how much time a guy is going to get, and then you tack on whatever's left. So this idea that Mr. Boyd can, you know, he knows about this program and that he's going to say, no, judge, no, I don't want to do that. And the judge is going to say, well, you get 10 more years. I mean, it's just, I think it's unrealistic, to be honest with you. But see, my time's up, and thanks.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.